Welcome to the STEMdaddy Network. I'm Charles Mudd, the host of STEM Voices. With STEM Voices, we want to bring you, the listeners, young, old, anywhere in between, the voices of those individuals contributing to the advancement of science, technology, engineering, math, and so many related subjects. We believe that we should all encourage young girls and boys, men and women, to pursue those opportunities in STEM-related fields. We live in exciting times. No longer are trips to the moon or colonization of Mars simply the imagination of science fiction. They actually happen to be the topics of real discussions. We explore and learn new planets. Science is bringing us so many advancements. These are indeed exciting times. And to that end, we hope that our programming might encourage, might inspire any one individual out there, perhaps you, to explore things STEM-related. With that, I hope that you sit back, relax, and enjoy this broadcast of STEM Voices on the STEMdaddy Network.
Hi, this is Charles Mudd, your host on STEM Voices, part of the STEMdaddy Network, along with our sister shows, Startup Radio, and Gaming Chords. But today, I'm excited to be talking with Laura Sampson about her involvement in the sciences and astrophysics and infectious diseases and so forth. And very glad to have you here on STEM Voices, Laura.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So you have, what I'd like to do is kind of talk about how you just recently shifted from one area of science to another area that at least in my mind seemed quite distinct. Maybe there's a connection I don't see. And so we'll introduce that to the listeners. But then I want to start from the beginning and how you became interested in science and so forth. So we came, STEM Voices, came to learn about you from your work and tenure at Northwestern University as a postdoctoral fellow in doing work with astrophysics. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That is correct. I was at Northwestern for a year and a half.
And that was the Center for Interdisciplinary Exploration and Research in Astrophysics, or is it pronounced Sierra?
Sierra, yeah. Good job. It's a long acronym.
So astrophysics, and then now you are doing a postdoc with the Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics with Penn State out in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And was that one of those intended switches in the profession or in your focus, or was that more an opportunity that came in front of you?
Yeah, it was pretty serendipitous. So I went to graduate school in Bozeman, Montana, and had a good friend there who was studying the propagation of pneumonia in bighorn sheep, which it turns out is a big problem in the western states. And she knew people at Penn State who were working on infectious disease dynamics, and this position came up and she recommended me for it, and I thought it sounded exciting and moved into it. So that's sort of logistically how it happened. The connection between astrophysics and disease dynamics, which wasn't super obvious to me to begin with either, is that I am in both fields, I specialize in statistical analysis. So it turns out that you can use the same tool sets in astrophysics as in disease dynamics to make inferences based on different types of data that you've measured.
Very interesting. So there is there is some connection between the two. But mm-hmm. So let's take a step back though, and you were saying that you studied out west, and mm-hmm. I believe before talking before the show began, you were indicating that you're from the West and kind of have been moving further east along the way. But let's go back in time, and how did your interest in science begin?
So I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, which is a super techie, sciencey town. So the schools that I went to always had science fairs and always had good science programs. And my dad always was very enthusiastic about having my sister and I participate in that. So I always thought of myself as a science person from elementary school onward. And like a lot of kids, I originally thought I wanted to be a veterinarian, and then eventually when I got into middle school and later high school and started being exposed to the physical sciences, I realized that I really enjoyed physics and math, mostly because of the sort of puzzle-solving logical aspect to it. So there was no sort of eureka moment. I just always was sort of on a STEM track.
Right. And then did that lead, what was your, what major did you begin with in undergrad?
Yeah, I started as a physics major at University of Colorado,
And did you
and
stay a physics major,
I
unlike many
stayed a
people
physics
that
major.
change?
Yes, I did not let Calc 2 derail my plans. But yeah, so I ended up studying gravity in particular because it was the class that I found the most interesting as an undergraduate was general relativity, and that's sort of what propelled me along the path that eventually I ended up at Northwestern.
Speaking of general relativity for a moment, have you been watching the new series? Just and this is not any paid endorsement, it's just clearly a curiosity. The new Einstein series
I
on
haven't
National,
seen any
I
of
think
it,
it's
but
National Geographic.
yeah, it's National Geographic. I heard about it because we did sort of an outreach. There's been a lot of outreach events around Einstein lately because not only because of the first detections of gravitational waves, but because it's about 100 years since relativity was published or general relativity was published. So I haven't seen the National Geographic one, but I've heard good things.
I would continue those good things. I'd recommend anybody interested in physics, science, it's worth the watch. I think it's certainly, I would say, TV-14, perhaps. I don't know what it's rated or not, but for any children or young adults out there, parents listening, it's a great show, but just as a caveat, it is kind of a, it has adult themes throughout. In dealing with his relationship with his spouse and or spouses and so forth. But circling back to gravity, so in college, gravity intrigued you and you found that interesting. And did you stay focused on that? Because you mentioned gravitational waves and you were looking while you were at Northwestern, you were doing analyzing some of the information related to the gravitational wave detectors. So was that a consistent theme from undergrad through your graduate school education, gravity and gravity-related topics, or did you come back to that?
Yeah, so in undergrad, I did several different, we call them REUs, research experience for undergrads. They're funded by the NSF, and you go and you do research in different types of labs over the summer. And so I did a couple of those in a couple of different subfields of physics, so high energy physics and optics, and then finally a little bit of gravity. And so by doing the research in those different subfields, I found that I really liked studying gravity. And so then in graduate school, I focused, all of the research that I did was focused in that area of gravitational waves. Coursework is broader, just because everyone takes sort of the same set of courses as a graduate student, but the research that I've done has been almost exclusively on gravitational waves.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I am fascinated, and our producer Lindsay will agree that I've become fascinated with all things space and coming from a strong liberal arts background, philosophy, and then master's in political science and law school. I although I've always been interested in math and science from the formal degree perspective, I lack that background. But nonetheless, I dove in this past spring, into an astrophysics class and just loved it. But there's been a lot of talk about gravitational waves, not only in 2016, and I think I forget if the first detection through LIGO was 2016 or 2015, but then we just heard an announcement like last week or maybe the first part of this week about another detection of a gravitational wave. And since you have the experience, why don't, if you could, explain to me and our listeners exactly what we're talking about when we're discussing gravitational waves. What are they?
Right. So the sort of standard explanation is a gravitational wave is a ripple in space-time. And what that means is if you sort of think about the space that we're existing in as the surface of a pond, and you move something large around in that surface, ripples spread out from what's moving. And that's very much analogous to what gravitational waves are. So any mass or energy moving generates them, but the big ones come from really big, dense objects like black holes. And so when one of these waves passes through the Earth, what it does is it very, very slightly changes, first shrinks and then stretches the space between two points. So a gravitational wave moving through you squeezes and stretches you a little bit. And it's an
insanely tiny
amount.
But we wouldn't be able to detect
that
ourselves.
No. If you had a gravitational wave hit you that was strong enough for you to feel, there would be lots of problems going on for the Earth.
Right. Right.
So the waves that hit the detectors are called LIGO, were so weak that they changed, the change in distance that LIGO detected was less than the width of the nucleus of an atom.
Okay, let's stop there for a second. And it's really fascinating and so forth, but I'm sure there are some people out there listening that would say, how in the world can you detect that small of a change, and how would you know that that change is not from the vibrations of the truck driving over?
Right.
'Cause LIGO's underground, right? Or is it on
not
top?
Not really. It consists of 2 4-kilometer arms, so they're kept perfectly flat. So they have to be dug into the ground a little bit to account for the curvature of the Earth, but it's not really underground.
Okay. But still, theoretically,
truck, how does this work?
Delivering supplies could cause a vibration.
Absolutely.
So how do we account for that?
Right. So first of all, the way that they're measuring this change in distance is, like I said, LIGO consists of 2 arms set at a 90-degree angle. So it's like a giant L, where each side of the L is 4 kilometers long. And what you do is you shoot a laser up and down each of the arms, bouncing off mirrors at either end. And the amount of time that it takes the laser to go to one mirror and back to the center tells you how long the arm is. And by combining the laser light from the 2 mirrors, one at each end of each arm, you can detect when the length of one of those arms changes. And now, like you said, all sorts of things are much stronger than gravitational waves. So you can see trucks driving by, you can see planes overhead, you can see waves crashing on the shore hundreds of miles away. It's an incredibly sensitive machine. And the way that you know that you're looking at a gravitational wave is that you have 2 of these machines, one in Washington State at Hanford and one in Livingston, Louisiana. And in order for a signal to be a gravitational wave, it needs to look the same in both detectors and happen at essentially the same time, right? You know, it hits one detector first and then the other. But we know that gravitational waves should travel at the speed of light, so we know how much time should be between the two. So that's the simple answer, is that you have to look for the same signal in two detectors at once.
And my understanding is that the international community, there are a number of other detectors out there, and there are plans for more and even larger detectors to continue to facilitate the exploration of gravitational waves. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So there is a detector in Italy called Virgo that is run by the European collaboration, and that detector is now functioning and will be collecting data soon, or perhaps already is. There's another detector that is currently under construction in Japan called Kagra. This one will be underground, and it will be cryogenic because it's Japanese, so it has to be more advanced technology. And then in the future, we will be building another detector in India. And now having all of these different detectors both helps you detect more quiet gravitational waves because you can be more sure if you see it in multiple detectors. But it also helps us localize on the sky where the gravitational wave came from. So the way that we know where the gravitational wave originated is by using triangulation. So if you only have two detectors, you can't triangulate, right? There's only two points. So you have a really broad area that it could have come out of. By turning on the third detector, the one in Italy, will highly decrease the uncertainty in where the signal originated.
And all of this, as you said, the amount of energy to create the gravitational wave that's strong enough to go from however many millions or billions of light years away through to the Earth, as small as the measurement is, it still had to have been a massive amount of energy to create a ripple to extend that far and keep moving. So it's presuming, of course, that is two black holes circling around one another because their gravity pulls them together, and then finally they merge and collide, I guess. And so what's interesting too is that, of course, that presumes that black holes exist, and we have detected the existence of black holes. Since we really can't see them per se, we also detect the existence of black holes through gravity as well, right? Because they're the movement of objects that we can see around what is black there. There must be something massive enough to affect their rotation. So is that how we come to the conclusion that there might be, or that there is a black hole in a particular area?
So general relativity predicts the existence of black holes. They just come out of the mathematics. The best
Interesting.
observational evidence that we have for a specific black hole, what you're alluding to, is called Sagittarius A star, which is at the center of the Milky Way. And you're right, if you point telescopes at the center of the Milky Way and observe how the stars at the very center are moving, they're all orbiting one point, but there's nothing we can see at that point. So we can infer how much mass should be there because we know how to calculate how the stars should move given the mass at the center. And we can calculate how small the area must be. And the only thing we know of that could have those two characteristics is a black hole. So then we can use gravitational waves to sort of test whether what we're seeing is really black holes because we make very precise predictions for what the gravitational waves should look like if they are generated by black holes. And then we look for any deviations from that expectation.
And what's even I mean, all of this is fascinating, but for those listening, and fill in the details if I leave these out, but my understanding is that the whole LIGO project, the whole, detection of gravitational waves goes way back to when the theory first came about, and then I believe that there were scientists that set about trying to develop the mechanism to perhaps measure gravitational waves back in the 60s or 70s, and from that point, it took so long to actually get the two facilities built and set up. And then, strange as it may be, from my understanding, it's they turn the switch to test the operations of the LIGO detectors. Everybody goes home, goes to sleep, and lo and behold, they detect something that night. And the first reaction was that it must be an anomaly and that it was really not so coincidentally a gravitational wave. But in the end, it turned out that that was an actual confirmed detection of a gravitational wave. Is that,
yes.
You kind of have more of the backstory on that, I'm sure, but is that a general...
That's the general outline is absolutely spot on. So when gravitational waves were first predicted in one of Einstein's papers on general relativity, there were actually a couple decades where people argued over whether they were real or just an artifact of the math. And then eventually someone had a paper come out proving that they really were real. People tried to detect them using these giant bars that would have a resonant frequency, so like a tuning fork, basically.
Hmm.
And weren't able to do it with that. So that was like in the 60s and 70s. And then I think the concept for LIGO started in the 80s. And there was an initial version that was on in the early 2000s that wasn't sensitive enough to detect gravitational waves. And they did a recommissioning to advance LIGO, which is running now. And then, yes, they were technically still in the engineering phase, but had the machine on and quiet and working well when the first gravitational wave struck. Its name is GW150914, which is very creatively just the date that it was detected on. One of the things that we do to make sure that our detection pipelines are working is we'll inject fake signals into the data. And so everyone's first thought was, oh, this is a fake signal. And then we realized that we didn't have everything set up to inject a fake signal. And so we did everything possible to rule out that this is not a gravitational wave, up to and including could we have been hacked by someone who maliciously injected a fake signal. But no, it was real. So it was very exciting.
Well, that's fantastic. And so there's LIGO, the ground-based detectors, but you were also involved with or worked with NanoGrav.
Mm-hmm.
What is NanoGrav?
NanoGrav is another way to detect gravitational waves. So it's the North American Nanohertz Gravitational Wave Observatory. So gravitational waves, just like light, come in all sorts of different wavelengths. And the wavelength of the gravitational wave is essentially the size of the object that emitted it. So the binary black holes that we've detected with LIGO so far, by the time they merge, are a few kilometers apart. So we can detect wavelengths on the order of a few kilometers or shorter. NanoGrav works on very much the same principle, where you're measuring the distance between two objects and seeing how that changes when a gravitational wave passes through. But the two objects now are the Earth and a pulsar, which is a very quickly rotating neutron star, which is a super dense star that comes after a massive star explodes in a supernova. And these very quickly rotating neutron stars have radio beams on them that sweep around like lighthouses. When those beams hit the Earth, we can detect it as pulses. That's why we call it a pulsar. The rate of rotation for these stars makes them almost the best clocks in the universe. For a while, they were more stable than atomic clocks.
Really?
Now atomic clocks have gotten better. Yeah, it's insane. And they spin thousands of times a second. So they're really cool objects in and of themselves. But by measuring the time between pulses, you can detect if the pulsar is getting closer or further away from the Earth because they're emitted at such a steady rate. So if a gravitational wave comes between us and the pulsar, it will change the time between those pulses, and if we detect that change in time, we can detect the gravitational waves. Now, these ones would be from supermassive black holes merging, and a supermassive black hole is something like Sagittarius A star, like the black hole at the center of our galaxy. So it would be from galaxy mergers throughout the history of the universe. By detecting them, you could learn about how galaxies formed and how structure has formed over time.
That's amazing. Do you miss working, you know, now with the Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics? Do you miss the astrophysics and the astronomy part of it, or are you're good with moving on?
I still really like hearing about all the news and stuff that's going on in astrophysics, but I was ready to apply my skills to a new challenge. I still think it's very cool, and I'm glad lots of people are working on it.
Yeah, and I agree with you completely. I mean, it fascinates me to no end. I mean, I truly so much so that it prompted me to take this class this past quarter, and
Right.
it was just and that's only expanded my interest. And kind of to some extent, I wish that I had gone in a different direction degree-wise long ago, but then I wouldn't be where I am today necessarily. But in something I've read, you wrote that at the heart you're a data scientist, and I think that that goes to what you said when we first started the program, and that the connection, though it wasn't necessarily there facially there when you went from astrophysics to infectious diseases, but it's the statistics and the analysis behind that, and working with the data, whether in astrophysics or infectious diseases. And so, if you consider and you describe yourself as a data scientist, that really hasn't changed. It's really the application of that has changed.
Exactly.
Do I fairly
Yeah.
characterize that?
Absolutely. So it's something that I've realized over graduate school and during my work while I was at Northwestern that, well, I find the subject of astrophysics interesting and physics interesting. The part of the work that really excites me and that I'm passionate about is the data analysis side. So how do you get information out of data, essentially? You have all of these streams of numbers coming in. What information do they contain, and how do you make those inferences? And so that kind of puzzle exists all over the place. And so it's been kind of fun and a new challenge to try to apply my skill set to a new field.
Well, let's talk about that new field. But before we do, I want to mention too, and I want to say congratulations belatedly, because for your work or participation in the research on gravitational waves and so forth, last year you were awarded or named a 2016 L'Oréal USA for Women in Science Fellow, and one of only five nationwide to receive the honor in 2016. So congratulations. But can you, before we dive into infectious diseases, can you tell us a little bit about that and how that came about?
Yeah, so L'Oréal as a company, I was unaware until I applied for and got this fellowship. Does a lot of work in promoting women in STEM. Over half of their STEM workforce is female, which is unheard of. And the reason that they started this fellowship, which is a $30,000 1-year grant to support women in all fields of STEM, is because they wanted to hire female chemists a couple decades ago, and they couldn't hire enough. So they thought, hey, we have money, we can try to help solve this problem. And so I applied because my boss at Northwestern told me about the program, Vicky Caligara, who runs Sierra. And yeah, the process is just you tell them about the research you do and the kind of work that you want to do going forward, and they select people from there.
That's fantastic. Well, congratulations again. And it's really good to hear that there are corporations out there that have a vested interest in promoting STEM, and particularly among women and kids and so forth. I think that the more that everybody works toward promoting STEM in as young as possible, I think it's fun. I mean, it's exciting,
Absolutely.
and it's exciting and fun to see the kids enjoy that as well. And going to the science fairs, as you mentioned, when you were growing up and being involved in that. And so I certainly try to do everything that I can to help promote that, including STEM Voices on the STEM Dadia Network. Now, before we get to your discussion of infectious diseases, this is a great time to take a break from our discussion for a word from our sponsors. So we'll be right back on STEM Voices. All right, we're returning. We're back here with Laura Sampson on STEM Voices. We've talked about astrophysics. We've talked about science fairs, STEM, her receiving the 2016 L'Oreal USA for Women in Science Fellow. Very exciting. And now we left talking about how, at its core, you could describe yourself and have described yourself as a data scientist, and that kind of connects your work between astrophysics and infectious disease studies. So why don't you tell me what you're doing? Because that also sounds really exciting, and I want to hear you describe what your day is like. What are you doing out there now?
Yeah, so I'm, like you said, I'm at Penn State now in central Pennsylvania, and I'm working with a group headed by Matthew Ferrari, and we work mostly on modeling measles epidemics. So measles still kills a lot of children in developing countries, even though it's mostly been taken care of in the U.S. because vaccines are extremely effective and do not cause autism. And we work with money from the Gates Foundation and the NSF and the CDC to try to design the best intervention strategies, both to prevent and respond to measles outbreaks, typically in sub-Saharan Africa, but we also look at India and China and other places.
So let's take a step back and talking about measles. So in the United States, is measles still a big issue in the United States?
No, it shouldn't be.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
It shouldn't be. So,
but it is.
There are some outbreaks occurring in some places where vaccination rates have dropped too low. So if you have a certain percentage of the population vaccinated for measles, it's like 95%. If somebody gets sick, it's extremely unlikely that they'll run into somebody who's not vaccinated, and so the disease won't propagate.
If they do.
If people stop vaccinating for whatever reason, if a sick individual is around, they have a much higher probability of running into someone else who's vulnerable, and that leads to an outbreak. So it's still not a big problem in the United States, but for instance, there is a recent outbreak in Minneapolis. There have been outbreaks in Southern California. And for most older people, measles isn't that big of a deal, but it can be very dangerous for little kids.
And let's talk
and a lot
about
of
that
babies
for a
can't be vaccinated. So
yeah, and you know, I have two sons, and they're you know, around somewhere between 9 and 12, 13 years old. And there was the whole debate. I don't know that it really was a debate necessarily, but there was a discussion and a concern not too long ago about the MMR vaccination, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the correlation, which has turned out to be not true, so that we're very clear, but there was a scientist, and maybe more, but there was a suggestion that the MMR vaccination had a correlation to autism. And that correlation has turned out to be false. Am I correct on that? Do you know?
That's correct. There's no link between vaccinations and autism.
And I think it's not only that it just has been discovered that the information was wrong. I think it's been discovered that the guy just wasn't reporting necessarily.
There was some data manipulation going on.
So for any parents or future parents or anybody out there listening, there is not that connection between the MMR vaccination and autism. And so there's really no reason not to get the MMR vaccination for your children that I know of. I mean, who knows, you talk to your individual physician about that, but at least that's not there. And there's every reason to get the MMR vaccination because that then helps prevent measles, mumps, and rubella, which, as you said,
exactly,
Laura, for a young child can be very significant.
Exactly. And it doesn't only protect your children, it protects people who, for whatever reason, can't be vaccinated. So very young kids, people with immune disorders, people who might have an allergy that, you know, there are some medical reasons why some people might not be able to get vaccines, but autism is not one of them.
And that's a good point, and that's kind of why I backtracked a little and said talk to your physician, because there very well be individualized reasons why for a particular individual, but there's not a global reason not to, and that's
exactly
what I was trying to convey there. So that's a good point, and you're absolutely right. It protects those that can't, because if your child can be vaccinated and is, then that individual ideally is not going to get the disease, the illness, and therefore not be in a position to possibly infect the individual that has not had the vaccination. And so it's all contributing as part of the society that if as many people as possible that can receive the vaccination get it, we're protecting everybody.
Exactly.
So you said like 95% were good in the United States, and we've kind of made that little public service announcement that the connection MMR and autism is really, it's not a connection, and talk to your physicians out there, your pediatricians or and so forth. But for other countries, from what I hear you say, measles is much more of a concern.
Yes, there are lots of countries, you know, in particular developing countries that don't have a great healthcare infrastructure yet, where the measles vaccination rate can be below 80%, which is not sufficient to prevent large outbreaks. And so people are working on vaccines.
Go ahead, sorry.
So yeah, people are trying to figure out how to address that with a limited number of resources and limited infrastructure.
So where does your modeling come in? And can you describe for our listeners what is modeling in this particular circumstance?
Yeah, so there's a purely theoretical side of modeling where you write down some equations that describe how a disease propagates through a population. So it basically tells you if I have a set number of people and a disease that behaves in a certain way, how many people will be infected at any particular time, how many people will be infected total over an epidemic, that sort of thing. So that's the sort of theoretical modeling side of things. And then the more data analysis side is if I can observe certain things from countries, right? So data that's reported to me might be, okay, there were this number of infections at this clinic. We tested 20% of them and are sure that 20% were measles, but the other ones we know just had a fever and rash. So then you would say, given that kind of data from clinics around a country, how do I, for instance, infer what percentage of the population is vaccinated? Because I know what we're trying to do, and I know what interventions, either governments or NGOs have tried to make, but I don't know how effective they are without trying to measure it. So that's the sort of analysis that we do.
And do you use a particular programming language or programming languages to work in to do that?
I code mostly in Python. A lot of people in this field use R, which is a statistics package, basically. And in the past, I've coded in C, but Python is what I use now.
And were you using Python in astrophysics as well?
Yeah, I had just, so in my dissertation, I used C, and I switched to Python as a postdoc.
Do you enjoy
there's
Python?
There's a lot of pre-written functions in Python. Yeah, it's nice. The plotting is easy, interacting with it is easy.
I really dove into it this past spring, and I really enjoyed. I mean, I enjoy programming anyway. I'm not proficient. I'm not that good, but even like doing the HTML coding for a website or getting in and so forth.
That's like a little
really
logic
had a
puzzle.
Lot of fun in Python. I'm sorry?
Yeah. So I feel like coding is like a little logic puzzle. How do I use this
right.
predetermined set of instructions to do what I want to do?
And then it's fantastic. It's like a eureka kind of moment when you actually get, at least for me, when it works
oh, absolutely.
And you get it to do what you want it to do.
Yeah.
So
yeah, most scientists have to use coding, but very few of us have any formal training in it. So I definitely still have those eureka moments.
So let's talk about that. I mean, looking back on your career so far, your education and so on, is there anything that you wish that you would have done differently? Or is there something, the reverse, is there something that you look back and say, thank goodness I did that?
I like very much where I've ended up, so I don't think I would change anything drastic. It would have been good to have some programming classes in undergrad, and I think more physics programs are requiring them now. But when I was an undergrad, we didn't. So there was a lot of learning through osmosis when I was a graduate student. But in general, it's just been kind of a fun ride, so I don't think I would change anything huge.
What would you recommend to young children that are interested in STEM? What from your experiences would you recommend to them to do if they have that interest, or they think that they may have that interest in the STEM-related areas?
I think that the biggest thing is just to explore all of the areas that you find interesting and have fun with it. You don't need to get, if you want to try to get involved with research when you're in, you know, high school, you can, but you don't have to. You don't have to take everything really seriously. Science can just be a lot of fun. So you don't need to identify your life passion when you're 10 or 14 or 22, really. There's lots of different paths you can take, and if you're having fun doing STEM, then there will always be something for you to do. I see a lot of people who think that they need to focus on a very detailed path much earlier than they do.
Yeah, and I think that from what I've observed, I think that to a large extent our society or certain segments of the society tend to put a lot of pressure on kids and children early on. And we all want them to do well and everything like that, but you know, all of the standardized tests, and I'm not saying that standardized tests are necessarily bad, but all of that and focusing all so early that I like what you said, and at least in the terms that they don't need to decide what their final profession is going to be or what they're focused on at 10 or 12. I mean, I know I changed majors, even though you stayed physics, which I'm impressed by. I changed a couple times majors in college, and so you don't need to know, and I agree with what you said, that it should be fun. It should be an opportunity to explore, and if you take a class in one area and you're not really enthralled with it, then take another, and I think that that's the way to find your way in life anyways, to get out there, experiment, find what you enjoy doing, explore that, and so forth.
Exactly. Because I stuck with physics through graduate school, but now I'm a biologist, so you never know.
There you go. There you go. And that's a good point. Did your sister go into science or math or anything like that as well?
Yes, she's a physician assistant, so she's in the medical field.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And what was like the largest hurdle that you had to overcome, do you think? Or were there any hurdles?
I don't recall anything in particular. I think imposter syndrome is real. If people haven't heard of that, it's the sense that you have gotten where you are by fooling people, and pretty soon they'll all realize that you shouldn't be there. that was that was definitely the way that I felt through a lot of graduate school. But so did everybody else, is what you have to realize. You know, if you've gotten somewhere, you deserve to be there. Just keep working hard and things will get better.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, that was just
but I think
self-confidence is hard sometimes, but
yeah, and I can understand that, but I think that you're right in that, you know, if somebody finds themselves where they are, then they must have done things right and obtained the right scores and the grades or the recommendations and so forth to get there, whether
mm-hmm.
it be Northwestern
yeah.
or where you are now or wherever one happens to be. But I think that phenomena happens a lot when, like, you wake up one day or you leave work and you think to yourself that it is so cool what I am doing that I can't believe I'm actually doing that, right? I mean, it's because when I think that's part of it is that you enjoy it so much that you can't believe that you're actually doing it and that you're there.
Right. You can't believe they're paying you.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Well, I think that it's fantastic that, you know, you've done what you've done and been involved in the gravitational waves, which is one of, like, the biggest scientific discoveries of this decade, if not, you know, this century so far. And so that's really awesome to have been involved in that. And now... what you're doing with infectious disease dynamics. So I want to circle back to that just for a moment. And so what you're studying, will the outcome be something that will help us better implement vaccination policies to combat diseases? Is the end goal of what you're working on?
Yeah, the end goal is policy recommendations for people who are on the ground implementing this kind of thing. And that's part of what appealed to me about this job is the direct impact on people
right.
from the type of stuff that we do. Astrophysics is very cool and people are interested and we should keep studying it because humans are curious, but developing a better vaccination strategy for the World Health Organization to implement is much more immediately gratifying. So that's the sort
sure.
of thing that we work on.
And so those policy recommendations would perhaps go to, like, the WHO, and then they would pass those down or get those to local people on the ground level about
yeah.
ways to implement changes to get that percentage of people vaccinated higher to where the threshold then actually has an impact and can hold off kind of a measles outbreak. Is that a
exactly.
fair assessment?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, I think that you're right in that will have very real consequences, not only for the people on the ground implementing those policies, but then thinking of the people that will be saved from the disease, and particularly where the science exists to help prevent that. I mean, I agree with
yeah.
your... I can understand how you can feel, as you said, having that impact because the science is there to help prevent things. And when we're able to use that and help people, I mean, that's the magic of science. I mean, that's the magic of advancement.
Exactly. We don't have to guess. We can know for sure what the best thing is to do. So.
Well, I really appreciate the time that you've provided to STEM Voices. I've enjoyed this conversation, talking both about your work with measles and developing vaccination policies and modeling and figuring out the best way to do that, as well as hearing about your experience with the gravitational wave detection, LIGO, and astrophysics. One final thing, if there was the most important course that you've taken, what would that be that you did take?
linear
And this is not
algebra.
so much for me, but for the kids out there, the people, the those that are interested in STEM. If you say one course, and you said algebra, was that it?
Linear algebra. Yeah,
Linear
so
algebra.
a
All right.
lot of statistics and data manipulation comes down to being good at linear algebra, so pay attention.
And the one course that you probably wish you had taken, as you said, would maybe have been some programming.
Programming, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Laura. I really appreciate it again, and we wish you all the best.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So this is Charles Mudd, host of STEM Voices. It's been my pleasure to have a great conversation with Laura Sampson, who's now doing a postdoc with the Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics at Penn State, working on ways to help improve vaccination for measles. And those results, I'm sure, will redound to other diseases as well. It's been a fantastic conversation. Please stay tuned for more information about upcoming episodes on STEM Voices, and we wish you well. Have a great day.